Accession number 9338, reel 2.
Doug Turner, tape 2.
The General Crozier also had to suffer the abuse of the Sunday tabloid press because of his book, The Men I Killed. And it was very sad to know that this had happened just as he was on his deathbed as well.
Are there any other people that you know are outstanding?
I certainly recall Max Plowman, who had taken over the secretaryship of the Peace Pledge Union. Max had been a subordinate in the First World War and had just walked out when he felt that he could no longer participate in what was happening. And I met him later on in 1941 when he was then running the community which had been started by John Middleton Murray and himself in Essex, Langham Community. And Max Plowman's quiet solidity had tremendous influence in the movement. He was very, very deeply respected, not least because of his own experiences and of his own courage and clarity of writing.
Did you go to many big meetings that you recall? Did you go to any of these very big meetings?
I went to one or two, not too many, because by then... I think perhaps I'd better go back a bit here. In 1937, one of the Peace Pledge Union members, a fellow by the name of George Jones, had written a letter to Peace News asking members of the union if they would be willing to join him in a peace trek round the villages of Yorkshire in an endeavour to bring the Peace Pledge Union to their attention and, I suppose, in general, to propagate pacifism. I wrote to him and, in due course, met him and spent 2 months with him up in Yorkshire, travelling around the villages of East Yorkshire and talking with many, many of the simple people round there of our thoughts. It was certainly an experience in simple living, and had quite an influence in my own growth and development.
Did you have to give up your job to do that?
Yes, I did. I was already working for a local baker's, and they were quite disturbed by my giving notice. They endeavoured to persuade me to remain on, and again delayed my actual departure by deliberately not recruiting a new roundsman, but ultimately I forced the issue and duly departed. I met other pacifists whilst I was up there, particularly a young man named Edmund Coxedge, who perhaps comes into the story a little later on. George Jones himself and Edmund were able to go to the Great Swanwick Camp, but I had returned home then, my father not being too well.
It's before I ask you about the later events, could I ask you more about this sort of a peace trek you had, wasn't it, with George Jones?
Yes.
Did he have a base in Yorkshire at all? You know, where did this all occur from?
Yes, we did. We had a very friendly farmer, George Dixon, who had been a great admirer of Shepherd. And he opened his farm to all and sundry in the peace movement. Indeed, many people who went overseas working in peace activities spent periods with George. Again, George is an interesting character because he was a Methodist lay preacher who, in the First World War, as a young man of 18, had been very keen on joining the RAF. He didn't do so. The war was over before that happened, but he began to develop strong pacifist ideas in the late 20s and 30s and became a great tower of strength to the peace movement in East Yorkshire. Indeed, there were many, many Methodist preachers in that area who linked up with him, and he was a great strength to the whole Peace Pledge Union in the north.
Could I ask you a little more about what you actually did when you went on your travels? What was the aim of this? You know, what were you deciding to do?
I think our aim was to try and reach out to people. It was an experience. It was, I suppose, also an experiment. We went round to the... because we felt, I suppose, that the governments of the world were against the simple people of the world. And I suppose we saw in the rural areas the symbolism of the simple people of the world. Thus, we went to see meet the simple people. I think most people really listened to us and gave us a good hearing. We had very little opposition, except perhaps when we went into the towns. But generally speaking, the country people in East Yorkshire did listen to us. I would not necessarily say that would apply to the other parts of England, however. I think that possibly the strong Methodist tradition which existed there played a very real part in their sympathy towards the pacifist movement.
In the towns, you said you had opposition sometime. What form would that take? You know, would you be giving
speeches?
Well,
for example, we used to sell peace news on the streets, and quite frequently we would get abuse from people passing by, and even from sometimes, occasionally from members of the police force. Certainly I remember that happening in Suffolk, quite strong opposition. Not so much from the ordinary bobby on the streets, but from the hierarchy. Fortunately, we were able to cope with that through sympathetic counsellors, and they duly had their knuckles wrapped. But certainly there were endeavours to get us off the streets. It was rather interesting at times when we were selling peace news, because I remember distinctly when I used to sell them in Bromley, in the High Street, on a Saturday evening after I'd finished work. On one side of me would be the local communist selling the Daily Worker, and on the other side would be the local fascist selling Action. And the abuse they were shouting at one another by Action and Read the Truth and by the Daily Worker and Know All About It. And I in the middle was saying, well, why war at all? Why war at all? Read Peace News. Quite strangely enough, we used to receive quite a fair hearing, I think, from both sides. Whether it was because they were getting at one another and wanted to use us or not, I don't know. The communists probably used to think we were, whilst socialist in outlook, didn't recognise the fascist threat, whilst the fascists saw us as possibly rather simple-minded do-gooders.
When you were on your peace trek, where did you stay the nights when you were travelling?
Now, most of the time, whilst I was there, we used George Dixon's base the whole while. We had a tent there, and George had a small hut in which we lived, and we looked after ourselves. We lived on a bare minimum. George Jones, and not to my prior knowledge, had adopted a philosophy called cosmotherapy, founded by Dr. Edmund Zachary, I believe. And the theory was that you lived on two meals a day. I was unaware of this. I'm not quite sure whether I'd have accepted those terms had I known what it meant. Nevertheless, I did. George expected it. And we lived on, I think, about 3 and 6 months each a week. Fortunately, George gave us sometimes eggs and milk, which kept us going. But the Peace Pledge Union did give us the small amount of money which we required. I left before they actually went on trek, and the trek then was to Swanwick, with George and Edmund trekking all the way down to Swanwick in Derbyshire with a little trek cart and doing publicity and propaganda work on their way down. The peace trek then came to an end at Swanwick Camp. That was its finale, with George Jones later on going to India, he himself having met Gandhi previously in London and being very thrilled by the man, had decided to spend his own life in India, which he went out there in 1938, and later on his fiancée went out to join him. But George unfortunately died within a year of a fever, leaving Margaret, his new wife, to continue on with his work. Unfortunately, their little baby died not long after, but Margaret continued working out there for quite a number of years before herself coming back to England, and I believe she died in England, I'm not sure.
It would seem from what you've been saying about this period, just before the outbreak of war, that your pacifism was becoming stronger, far more than, say, just a theory about life. Would you say that?
Yes, I think so. I think the peace movement had some brilliant minds within it. Huxley, Littleton Murray, so many, Joad for a while, and others, and they were able to verbalise, I think, our feelings and emotions. This gave us great strength. It made us realise that not only did we have guts in our springing from our guts, but also that there was an intellectual basis to our emotions. This helped us an enormous amount. It wasn't just an emotive movement. Not by a long, long way. And I began to argue with my opponents within my work and friends, and in no time at all I found myself able to cope almost with any question without any anxiety or worry at all. I don't think there was a question I was afraid of, much to the concern of... perhaps my old friends and workmates and employers, they would shrug their shoulders in despair and say, well, what do we do with him?
Did you see it your duty to be a missionary, to try and convince them?
I wouldn't use the term missionary, but certainly, yes, of course we did. I mean, it wouldn't have had any meaning had we not wanted to convert the whole world. I mean, there was no point in it. We didn't wish to be escapist at all. I mean, to us it was... it was a challenge of not just peace and war, but I suppose more and more it was becoming a challenge to our whole way of life. I mean, the pacifism then was beginning to lead to all sorts of new things. It just wasn't a political or a purely religious issue. It meant a complete restructuring of society. And the Labour Party certainly didn't seem to be offering that, and nor did any of the other political parties. The churches had nothing whatsoever to say.
Did you think that inevitable, you know, that the church should not support pacifism then?
I think it was a matter, I suppose, a matter of history. I mean, their behaviour during the First World War and most wars, I mean, was a pure escapism. It was just making Christianity a tribal religion. It was just a national religion, a religion and nothing else.
The peace camp at Swanwick, did you go there yourself?
No, I didn't. No, when I went back home, I had to go take on a job again, of course. And unfortunately, I did not get to Swanwick. I would have loved to have done so, because I gather it was an important point in the growth of the movement. I think from all reports, it was a something very impressive.
Was it a national sort of camp, or was it international?
No, I think they probably did have people coming in from the peace movement of other countries, because by this time we were linking up with, through the War Resisters International, the Peace Pledge Union began to reflect the peace movement of Great Britain. There had been a previous movement, the No More War movement, which was been rather falling to pieces. The Peace Pledge Union embraced the No More War movement, I think, and became really the power in the land.
How were you reacting at this time, Doug, to the events in Europe? You know, this would have been the occupation of the Rhineland, the Sudeten business, wouldn't it? And Austria. You know, were these things sort of affecting you at all?
Mm. I think there were times when we must recognise that we were terribly naive about Hitler. There was a lot of talk that the war was due to, the threat of fascism was due to largely economic reasons. Germany had been maltreated under the Versailles Treaty, and if we could only but readjust this, then Hitler would surely respond. This was naivety. But then we were no more naive than the establishment itself. They were even more naive because they knew. We didn't. They were aware of what was going on. This is not to say that we weren't immature at times. Of course we were, and many of us were young. This was to be expected. We had to grow. We had to learn the hard way as well. And as we saw the threat of Hitler growing, we did become aware, I think, that war was on the horizon. Nevertheless, it had not yet occurred. There were still hopes. I shall never forget, however, when Chamberlain went out to Munich in 1938. Even my father was impressed. He said, "I think this means peace." And I said, "I don't think it does." And we had quite a strong argument about this. And when Chamberlain came back, waving his scrap of paper, I do remember my father saying, "There, it is peace." And I said, "I don't think it is. I think it's going to be war." And I should never forget being, when he came back, feeling a sense of utter shame when he said, "Peace with honour." Because it didn't seem to me that there was any honour attached to that scrap of paper at all. I would rather have said that if war is honourable, then let us have war rather than that sort of peace. And I remember at work when I said this, everybody was turned around at me and said, "You, a pacifist, not welcoming Chamberlain's brave attempt?" I said, "I don't welcome Chamberlain's brave attempt." I really was ashamed of England at the time.
What was it that shamed you so, Doug?
I think that the France, Italy and Britain coming together and dismembering Czechoslovakia. We had no right to do that. It was not pacifism. It was not peace. It was not in any way honourable. I say?
What was the alternative? What should Chamberlain have done then?
I don't know. I think we had gone past the point of no return by then, as so often happens in the political, in international sphere. What does one do if politicians will not really reach out towards a creative peace? Then there's only one alternative, and that was now appearing on the horizon. It was already too late. As so often, what does one do? How can one be a pacifist everyone rejects what one puts forward. There is no alternative. To me, it was just a repetition of the First World War. Everything which was happening in the world led up to the First World War. The politicians ignored all warnings, all the wise men, all the prophets. The same thing was now happening. Of course, pacifism hasn't got an answer in such circumstances. We can't have an answer.
You were saying after the peace trek that you went back to work.
Yes, I took on a job again in the bakery trade. But after my experiences in Yorkshire, of course, I was thinking more and more about the whole issue of peace, and particularly with war, the possibility of war occurring. When I was in Yorkshire, I had been made aware of a community existent in Wiltshire called the Cotswold Bruderhof. George Dixon had told me about this, and my thoughts had already been turning towards some kind of practical and voluntary socialism, because I felt that political socialism was very much a pie in the sky when you die kind of business. And I wanted to begin to live out my pacifism more positively. So it came about that in the summer of 1938, I spent my annual holiday going down to the Cotswold Bruderhof, which was in the little village of Ashton Canes, a few miles from Cirencester. The whole experience was a very exciting one indeed. Here was a truly international community who were living together, working together, sharing all things in common, and living what seemed to me a very practical Christian socialist life. Perhaps I ought to just give some brief background of the rising of the Cotswold Bruderhof. It had been founded in the 1920s after the First World War by a Dr. Eberhard Arnold, who had been very much involved in the student Christian movement. And after the war, there were many young people disillusioned with society, and they had come together in what was then called, I think, the German Youth Movement. It was nothing organised, I understand, in any kind of way, but it was just a free kind of concerned young people beginning to challenge the society as then existed, and the hopelessness and helplessness. And this had led Eberhard Arnold and other like-minded people together, and they had then felt the challenge of Christianity in a very deep way and had come together and thrown all their things together in common and had purchased a farm and were living in a full community. They had, I believe, many, many struggles in the early days, and ultimately, of course, over the years, they, as Hitler came to power, they found themselves more and more in an invidious situation, which resulted in the end by them coming to England and settling down in England in the mid-1930s. The movement had a very great influence over the social movement in Europe as a whole, particularly the pacifist movement and the Christian movements. They consisted largely of Germans, Dutch, Swiss, Scandinavians and British people joining them. And when they came to England, they had a great influence upon the peace movement. And they grew quite rapidly, drawing particularly from the pacifists in the United Kingdom. When I went down to them in 1938, I was certainly taken aback by the deep commitments which held them together. And whilst I found myself perhaps not able to agree with all their theology, yet their expression of life meant something very positive. At the same time, Edmund Coxedge had also been involved with them, and after I came back, I made contact with him again. He then working in East End of London from the social settlement Kingsley Hall. In November of 1938, there had been held there a community conference. This covered a wide range of social activities of different kinds, from people working in social settlements to more positive community expressions. And I went up there for the weekend and was very deeply impressed with everything which had been going on. Towards the end, Edmund stood up on the platform and said, "Well, we've done surely enough talking. Who wants to do something about it?" And about half a dozen of us said we did. And in the following weeks, we came together to meet every weekend at Kingsley Hall and decided that no longer could we continue to work in a society which meant war, inevitably meant war as we saw it, and that we must express our beliefs in a very positive way. By the end of the year, we had decided to throw our lot together, and within a few weeks we had obtained sufficient money by loans and small gifts to purchase a small farm in Suffolk, a farm of some 22 acres, I believe, and I think we paid something like £500 or £600 for.